You're going to hear a lot about Darwin this year. Not the city, but the man it's named for, Charles Darwin. There are two big anniversaries in 2009. He was born 200 years ago in February, and his groundbreaking book on the origin of species was published 150 years ago next November. It's difficult to overestimate the importance of his work. Darwin showed that different species have evolved over time, and that the great driver of evolution is natural selection. So, plants and animals and all living things with characteristics that make them more likely to successfully reproduce, succeed. And those characteristics are passed on and become reinforced. It sounds simple. It is simple, but it's one of the great cornerstones of biology, and it's why we can make sense of the enormous diversity of life on Earth. Now, you probably know all this, but did you know that Darwin married his cousin? I didn't either, until I read Steve Jones, the Professor of Genetics at University College London, and more importantly for us, the great popular writer and commentator on genetics and evolution. He's with me now. Welcome to Life Matters, Steve.
Hello.
Now, Darwin married his cousin. Why was that?
Well, it was quite common in those days. Still is quite common among the aristocracy. If you look at royal families, there's plenty of cousin marriage goes on, particularly, incidentally, in the Spanish royal family. There were various reasons. There were social reasons. You wanted to keep wealth in the family was quite often the reason. Quite often, families were very closed operations. People were brought up with their cousins, and nature took its course. Now, Darwin did marry his cousin, but he was concerned about the dangers of it. He was concerned that his children might turn out to be unhealthy. And that still is a concern in many parts of the world. It's not as justified as some people think, but there's some element of truth in it.
He and Emma, I think she's a Wedgwood, isn't she?
She was a Wedgwood, and not short of money, just like Charles himself.
Okay, so they were keeping it in the family. They had 10 children, and, well, quite a few of them had health problems.
That's right. It's a strange place, Down House, which was Charles's rather grand house south of London. It was a place where it was normal to be ill. Charles, for reasons we simply don't understand, he threw up all the time. He was vomiting and he took all kinds of strange drugs and treatments which did him much more harm than good. One of the things they don't point out to visitors when you go to Charles Darwin's study is that behind a curtain there's a chamber pot into which he would throw up first thing in the morning and last thing at night. So he wasn't well. And his children...
Just on that, Steve, can we speculate now as to why that might have happened?
Well, there's whole books been written about it, and the short answer is we don't know. There's two basic theories. One is, they're both speculative. One of which is that he was infected by a blood parasite, which gave him a disease called Chagas disease when he was in South America. And he mentions in his wonderful book, The Voyage of the Beagle, he mentions that he woke up one morning with black and blue blisters around his eyes. What was this due to? Well, we now know it was due to being kissed by a thing called a kissing bug, which carries this blood disease, which is very severe and leads to such symptoms. There have even been suggestions that we dig him up from Westminster Abbey and see if there's remnants of the parasite there, but the Abbey doesn't like the idea. The other idea, which has of course been much discussed, which I don't really believe, was that it was some kind of deep psychological problem he had because of the clash between his science and what had been his religious beliefs. I don't really think that's true, because these symptoms came on when he was a very young man in his early 30s. You know, he made this amazing journey around the world, 5 years, including quite a time in Australia and some quite tough journeys within Australia itself. And yet very soon after he got back, long before he wrote The Origin, he began to suffer these symptoms, and we don't know what they were.
All right, so it's not normal. It's normal at Down House, which was then, of course, in Kent, but now has been engulfed by London, for people to be ill. And, well, quite a few of his kids were very ill indeed.
Yes, so a couple of them died young. You've got to bear in mind, of course, that in Victorian times, that's what you'd expect. I start my introductory biology lectures at University College London, where I work, by telling the students, and maybe 500 in a class, to look to the person to the left and the person to the right. And I say reasonably accurately that 2 out of every 3 of them will die for reasons connected to the genes they carry, because we know that heart disease, diabetes, cancer, all these things have got quite a strong genetic component. So they look a bit glum at that, but then I say, cheer up, because if I'd been teaching you in Shakespeare's time, 2 out of 3 of you would be dead already. And of course, that was common. And even in Charles Darwin's time, when he was born, almost half of all English babies died before they were 21. So now it's the figures, of course, are 99% stay alive. Mm. So it was normal for children to die, which, of course, didn't mean that people didn't mourn them. I mean, Darwin was completely shattered by the death of his five-year-old daughter, Annie, who was obviously a very sweet young girl, died a terrible lingering death of a disease which we couldn't easily cure today, tuberculosis, she almost certainly had. And that really, I think, shattered his belief in the idea of a generous and beneficent God. He couldn't believe that anybody could possibly be so cruel.
I think they also lost two as infants, and Emma at 10, and that really shook him as well, didn't it?
Yes, that's right. They lost several children. There's some interesting stuff. I think when we're talking about cousin marriage, we have to be very careful to get our facts right. Lots of children die, not just the children of cousins. And there's been a lot of concern in Britain recently, and I imagine perhaps also
in
Australia.
We've talked about it here, actually. Yes.
You know, very stupid statements by government ministers, which you'd naturally expect on most topics. But one particular government minister came out with the extraordinary statement that everybody knows, and that's always a fatal clue, everybody knows that if you marry your cousin, you're likely to have a damaged child. That simply is not true. There's a small increase in the chance of 1 or 2%, which is about the same or less than the average age of a mother going up by 1 or 2 years, which of course is happening all over the developed world, in Australia as much as anywhere else. Mm. And nobody's concerned about that, but they're concerned about cousin marriage. So I think we have to be careful to get the facts right.
He was worried, though, about this, wasn't he?
He was very worried about it, largely because of his illness, as we've said. He was himself the cousin of a chap called Francis Galton, who is sometimes pointed at as the founder of human genetics. I'm not quite sure that he
eugenics
was.
Eugenics, which is a word which has a nasty connotation.
It has a very nasty connotation. It's still around today, one has to say. We make lots of decisions about pregnancy and fertilization on the base of genes, of DNA, and with IVF and so on, and selective termination of children of pregnancies with Down syndrome. People say you shouldn't call that eugenics. I think that's hiding away from the problem. Eugenics literally means being well born, and it was completely abused, of course, in Germany and elsewhere. But we still face those problems, and I don't think we can just look away from them.
Despite his concerns, several of his children ended up doing very well indeed, didn't they?
Well, if you call being Professor of Astronomy at Cambridge doing very well, I suppose they did, yes. And Mayor of Cambridge.
Hold yourself back, Steve.
Yes, they did very well. There's an interesting new fact that's just come out, which again is very preliminary. It comes from Iceland, and it's rather unexpected, but Iceland is one of the world centres for studying families, genetics, largely because the Icelanders are obsessed with their relatedness and their history, and they've got wonderful pedigrees. And it turns out that the children of cousins in Iceland are pretty healthy, it's no problem, but they have fewer grandchildren. In other words, if you have you marry your cousin and you have some children, you're less likely to have grandchildren than people who don't marry their cousin. And that's something kind of unexpected. And oddly enough, that was true of the Darwin family. The Darwins didn't leave many grandchildren. But whether that's really true, we're not yet quite certain. It's very new.
On Life Matters today, we're talking about the life and times of Charles Darwin, a man you're going to hear a lot more about this year because of the two anniversaries, 200 years since he was born, 150 years since the publication of Origin of the Species. And we are talking, I think, to the leading Darwin scholar, Steve Jones, who's Professor of Genetics at University College London. And the stuff that we're talking about is in his book, Darwin's Island, The Galapagos in the Garden of England. Steve, one thinks of Darwin as a great traveller, the voyage of the Beagle, the five-year thing, the journey we're all taught about at school. That was actually fairly early in his life.
Yes, he was about 21 when he left and 26 when he came back, and he lasted until his 70s. So he spent another 40 years and more on what I call, as you say, Darwin's Island, which is the island of Great Britain. And he never left again. When he came back, he had all kinds of plans to go and travel again, and he never did. But the frank answer is, you know, everybody in Sydney or in London or any other city in the world has got several Nobel Prizes waiting in their back garden. You know, there are many, many things you can do in a garden, as Darwin indeed did in his garden, in terms of we know nothing about what's in the soil, plants we scarcely understand. So you don't really need to travel. You know, Darwin's life was one long, not jet-lagged journey of the body, a short one for 5 years, but a 40-year-long journey of the mind, and that's where it really began to matter.
But he travelled a great deal within Britain, didn't he?
Yes, he went around a lot. A lot of it, bizarrely, was in search of various water cures and various quacks, as we now call them, who promised to cure his illness. He travelled around a lot. He went to Scotland quite a bit. He spent a long time in Wales, and I'm Welsh, so I'm kind of naturally proud of that. What's interesting, if you look at his diaries, even when he was a boy, he had what he later called a sense of enlarged curiosity. And you can see that because he went to West Wales, not only a few score kilometres away from his home in Shrewsbury. He went to the coast, where no doubt it was raining at the time, as it always does, and he found some kinds of insects. Bear in mind, he was about 9 or 10. Some kinds of insects which he didn't find in Shrewsbury. And he didn't just pin them in his insect book, which is what people did in stamp collecting. He wondered why. And that's what Darwin was the first biologist to do, was to wonder why. Why do you get different creatures in different parts of the world? Why do you get the remnants of extinct animals? Why can you breed more productive plants and more productive crops? Why is this? And what he did with his theory of evolution is most of all to invent the science of biology, which really hadn't existed as a single science before then, and to join the study of humans to the study of biology. And now Gilbert and Sullivan, the well-known operetta writers of HMS Pinafore and the like, they had a great phrase: Darwinian man, the well-behaved, is really but a monkey shaved.
Yes, remember that.
And we are, in some senses, we're shaved monkeys. We're much more than that. But it's Darwin who taught us that.
When I was introducing you, I mentioned Origin, but it's hardly the only thing he wrote. I mean, he was really rather prolific.
He wrote about 6 million words altogether, which is a lot of words, and I've glanced at most of them, and it's taken me a long time. In about 15 different books on subjects as different as plants that eat insects, on the emotions of men and animals, on the origin of sex, which is actually a very, very boring book. When I've told my students that they're going to die for genetic reasons, I go on to say on my genetics course that I'm a geneticist and my job is to make sex boring. And they look at me blankly. But of course, I'm right. And Darwin was even righter because he talked about sex in plants. So he did an enormous number of things.
I knew about barnacles and I knew about the earthworms, but emotions I did not know about. What did he have to say about them?
It's amazing. The Emotions book is just an amazing book. It was the first scientific book to be illustrated by photographs. Who knows that? It's extraordinary. And Darwin corresponded with a French biologist called Duchenne, the same bloke who the muscular dystrophy, the wasting disease found in some young boys, is found. And Duchenne was years ahead of his time, like Darwin, and he took little electric probes and he applied them to people's faces. A man of diminished intellect they hired.
You couldn't get that through an ethics committee now.
Well, you can. They do it. They do it now. I mean, I've had it done to myself. And it's remarkable. He puts the probes on and he makes him smile. He even did the rather disgusting thing, being France, of course, of going to the guillotine and picking up the head after it had been removed from the body and putting the probes on the executed man's head and making him have a big grin after death. That's a bit grisly. Darwin doesn't mention that. But what Darwin did was to look at that and realize that, you could measure emotional states by looking at people, and there's a thing, you can measure smiles very effectively. If you want to genuinely appear to smile, don't just smile, you have to raise your eyebrows as well. And if you don't raise your eyebrows, it actually looks rather sinister. And Darwin was the first person really to put that on an objective basis. And what he was doing is really exactly the same as all these sort of rather cranky brain scanners do. Everybody's heard about the center for emotion and the center for religion in the brain. Well, I take that no more seriously than I do Darwin's experiments with an electric battery and a probe.
So two things. One, it makes me now think of that's where the Duchenne smile comes from.
Yeah.
But the thing he really did was he showed that, just like limbs or the opposable thumb, that emotions have evolved.
Yes, and he went to London Zoo. In fact, oddly enough, I was there just the other week, and the keepers, I wanted to repeat one of Darwin's experiments. And Darwin's experiment, it wasn't an experiment, it was an observation, was to show a banana to the orangutan. I was going to do it with the gorillas because there are no orangutans in London Zoo anymore, and not give it to it and see what happened. And the keepers wouldn't let me do that because it was not ethical. It might upset the gorillas. Darwin did it, and he describes it very amusingly. It was just like a young baby. She rolled on her back and screamed and yelled, and it was just like a baby. Darwin wrote really the first text about infant behaviour. He observed his young son William, and he noticed what happened when you startled him or the first time he smiled. And he even began to get at the truth that, you know, there are two parties when you're communicating. There's the person who's coming out with the message and the person who receives it.
Yes.
Now, your viewers can't see this, but you're looking me in the eye. We're looking each other in the eye as we talk. And that greatly helps the communication. Darwin noted that some people really didn't do that. And that, we now know, is at the basis of lots of emotional problems, autism most of all, because what autistic children can't do is pick up the signals of affection which their parents are giving to them. They don't realise that. They live almost on Darwin's island of their own. They're separated in a little tiny private emotional landscape where they can't speak to people. And the technique, and they can't understand what people are trying to tell them. And the techniques which Darwin pioneered are now, of course, being used to study autism.
So that first effort, which was sketch of an infant looking at William, trickles right down into modern thoughts on autism. It almost sounds a bit like Charles Darwin as a kind of dispassionate observer of his children, but in fact he was anything but. He was very devoted and affectionate, wasn't he?
Yeah, the more you learn about him, you know, it's a bit like Sir David Attenborough. Somebody came up to me the other week who was writing a book about the history of the BBC. Deeply fascinating subject, I'm sure ABC listeners will know. Of course, the towering figure in the modern BBC, in the modern science of communication of science, really, is David Attenborough. And this person was desperate to find somebody who would say something nasty about Sir David Attenborough. And I've done a bit of work with him, and I was asked, you know, how important is he to scientists? And I said, tremendously important. And they looked disappointed. And they said, you know, we've asked dozens of people to say something nasty about David Attenborough, and we haven't found anybody who can do it. And Darwin was pretty much the same. Everybody admired him because he was so clever, but he was genuinely kind. He had a positive hatred of slavery. He was passionately opposed to slavery.
It was disappearing through his life.
It was disappearing. He was in Australia, and he was very, very uncertain about the way the Aboriginal peoples were being treated, which is, he had very advanced views for his time. So, you know, everything you learn about him, he was a kindly man and a genius. Unfortunately, I'm neither.
He obviously had a life of some privilege and comfort, and this gave him the freedom to do this. But would you say he had a happy life?
I think so. He wrote at the end of his life what he called an autobiographical sketch. And it's a very moving piece of writing, actually. He wrote it for his family. And I think he had, in his own way, a happy life. He even celebrated his illness because it allowed him to stay at home and work. So he was that very rare thing, a happy and fulfilled scientist.
That's where we'll leave it. Thank you very much for joining us today, Steve.
Thank you.
Steve Jones is Professor of Genetics at University College London. He's a former Reith lecturer as well. And his book, Darwin's Island, The Galapagos in the Garden of England, is published by Little Brown. And look, more on Darwin this evening on Late Night Live on ABC Radio National. But this is Life Matters, and I'm Richard Addy.